Whoa, whoa.
Okay. All right. Hold on. Okay, apologetics session 10. We're looking at the identity of Jesus tonight. We're actually looking at whether or not he was a liar. We're looking at the questions, did Jesus really believe that he was the Son of God? Was he lying when he claimed to be God? So last week we the existence of Jesus, and since many of us in here think already that Jesus exists, a lot of us didn't think that was much of an issue to discuss. But as with the rise of skepticism and postmodernism in the last 20 or 30 years, we realize that this belief that, or that Jesus did not exist, is a rather new claim, and it is being propagated on the internet and spreading rapidly. So before in the last 2,000 years, the claim was God did not exist by secular philosophers. Now the claim is much worse. Jesus did not exist. And if you don't believe God exists, if you don't believe Jesus existed, then you definitely aren't going to believe God existed or exists. That was kind of the meat of the issue last week. And the point I was trying to make is, if you can get your foot in the door in conversations with people that don't think that Jesus existed, and you can show them that view, Jesus did not exist, is faulty and fallacious and is not grounded in historical fact and not held by the majority of scholars, 99% of scholars, then the rest of the argument towards the resurrection falls out rather easily. And what we're going to see is that when you have a Jesus that exists and you ask the next question, okay, who was this guy? What did he do? What did he say? Then things start easily coming about towards, and you're easily on pace, on the path towards the resurrection, which is where we're trying to go. So the first step is to say, well, what did Jesus think about himself? Did he think that he was the Son of God? Did he think that he was God himself? If he did think that, was he a lunatic because he thought he was God? Or if he did not think that but said he did, was he lying? You may have heard the popular trilemma by C.S. Lewis, Liar Lunatic. Have you heard of this trilemma? Okay, so many of us have. And we're going to get into that a little bit. But right now, the popular claim or the scholarly claim, Jesus seminar, is that Jesus didn't even think he was the Son of God. Okay, so they are trying to get out of the Lord, Liar, Lunatic trilemma by first saying that Jesus himself didn't think he was the Son of God. So they're basically reinterpreting and redefining Jesus. And that's where popular claims and also claims by scholars, right there. Item 3, and we're under item 3, item A, and then there's another A there. Jesus wasn't even convinced that he was the Son of God. That's why he called himself the Son of Man. Interesting claim, huh? Jesus never claimed to be God. This was mistakenly declared by his followers. They attributed him with deity or divinity after he died. He said that the Father only knows certain things that he doesn't. So this idea that Jesus didn't know everything God knew, and he even said that himself, was very apparent in the Gospels, they say. And they say Jesus never claimed to be God. He claimed to be the Son of Man. And then this idea that Jesus was God was a fabrication and a later development and an embellishment by his followers. So this is the claim that we're hearing now on the streets and in the scholarly fields. Don Cuban is a philosopher and scholar and theologian. He's a Cambridge professor, and he's rather getting kind of old. And he's the one that kind of says this stuff. So this isn't, I'm not making this stuff up. I actually just heard this last week on a podcast or a couple weeks ago when I was kind of refining this. And that's what this next little chunk right here says. It just talks about Don Cupid and what he's saying in the Jesus seminar. And I'll read through it because it's a little little interesting. It says, recently, scholar Don Cupid, that's who he is and what he does, said that Jesus was one of the greatest radical secular humanists and most influential moral philosophers of the world. So he calls Jesus a secular humanist, which we talked about last week. He says the West owes much to the humanist teachings of Jesus. I can't believe he's saying this, but he does. He says Jesus did not say that he was God, and any such statement was a corrupt teaching attributed to him later on in textual alteration. Maybe that the scribes put that in there. Cupid claims that the Jesus seminar took 1,300 sayings of Jesus and threw them out, threw out almost all, but figured out through votes that 29 sayings were authentically historical. So he argues that he said the things he said. So we talked a little bit about that already. So it's interesting, though, but we all are thinking to ourselves, well, in the Bible passages I've read, Jesus clearly says to be the Son of God. But it's interesting, as well, there are three passages that I found, and maybe more, that I didn't find, but the ones I know of, he doesn't actually say the words, I am the Son of God. So we'll talk about that in a second. Question. So there's, say, a bunch of us like this, and we're all scholars and theologians. They all get together and meet occasionally, and they all look at a bunch of things, and then they vote on which ones are good and bad.
And are these sayings from the New Testament?
Yeah, they're actually taking the biographies, and they're chopping it up in little pieces, and they're saying, these pieces are not authentically Jesus. They're fabrications and embellishments, but Jesus really said this stuff, like, blessed are the meek, those sorts of things. But he didn't say these things. It's crazy. But they have reasons for it because they're scholars and they know things that we don't, right? That's their... So we need to ask ourselves tonight, did Jesus claim to be divine? Did he claim to be the Son of God? Or did the disciples make this up? Was he convinced that he was God? Could he have been lying? So all of these things are coming up now as that the Christians took for granted and easily just held as truth in the past, but now we actually have to defend. So what is it that sets Jesus apart from the founders of other religions? If we compare other people that, you know, like Confucius or Buddha, what sets Jesus apart? Jesus is the only teacher, sage, or founder who was predicted by prophecy and then fulfilled by prophecy, who claimed to be God, and who conquered death. Okay? No other religious leader or founder can claim those things. Wasn't predicted by prophecy. Buddha didn't conquer death, and Buddha didn't be God. This is very, very important. Neither did Muhammad. Okay? Neither did any other religious leader. I want to drill this into your heads, because when people are making the comparative religion argument, and all religions are the same and these sorts of things, it's just ridiculous. We could talk about comparative religion to the theological apostles. Leave it at that for now. I'm just trying to point out that Jesus distinguishes himself not only as a man, as a unique man, but even as a unique teacher and supposed founder of a religion. Other people who claim to be God are not sages in our culture and any other culture. So when there's someone who actually makes the claim, I'm God, we don't consider them a sage. We don't lift them up and put them on a pedestal and start following them. Usually we say they're a little off, right? So here I have some data in the Gospels that we're going to cover where Jesus clearly believed and claimed that he was God or was the Son of God. Now again, he doesn't specifically say, I am the Son of God, but he says things like this. Why then do you accuse me of blasphemy because I said, I am God's Son? So it's implied that he had just told them that. That's why he put it in a question. So it's implied that he said, I am God's Son. That's why he's asked it that way. So it's pretty clear that Jesus thinks of himself as God's Son. When he heard this, Jesus said, the sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. Well, who is he talking about if it's not himself? He who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father. So who's he talking about? The Son. Okay, so clearly it's implied Jesus thought of himself as the Son of God. All right? Now, there's other explicit statements saying where he says, I am the Son of Man. And that's pretty clear. But here it's implied, and it's just he didn't say the word, I am God's Son, like a statement. Part two. or note two, he did not correct others when they referred to him as. So this occurs over a dozen unique times in conversations with Jesus in the gospel. Nathanael, Martha, and Peter all call him the Son of God, and he doesn't tell them, no, you're wrong. I'm not God's son. He says, you just let them tell him that. The devil and demons call him the Son of God. When you read when they're tempting him and when the demons are talking to him when they're in people. So people are calling him Son of God all over the place, and he accepts it. And so what does he mean when he says Son of God, or when the Bible says Son of God? Well, Dr. Peter Kreft is a noted philosopher. He says the son of an ape is an ape, the son of a shark is a shark, the son of God is God. So, you know, from a certain genetic lineage, you are that thing. So in the early Christian time, the Christian theologians and bishops and the pastors of churches met and had these councils to start formulating and developing doctrines that weren't contradictory to each other. And they put together some terminology that was helpful for them at the time and helpful for us now. Homoousia, Latin word that is used often, and you hear it a lot when you go to seminary, because it's a word that means of the same substance or essence or nature. This is a word that was put together or borrowed from the Latin language and helpful for the early church theologians and early church fathers. Hypostasis is an individual instance of an ousia. Okay, you may be thinking this is really getting weird, but it's good for you to know these things, and you can impress your friends. Peter, James, and John are one humanity, but three hypostasis persons. So a hypostasis is an instance of an ousia, or in other words, it's a one happening or occurrence of an essence or a substance. Okay, so in other words, I have a cup here. This is an instance of a cup. It's a hypostasis, and the universal would be cupness. So it bears the properties of cupness. Okay, cupness is an abstract. You know, it exists in the abstract realm, and it's an essence in and of itself. So human exists in the abstract realm. It's an essence. It's an ousia. And I'm a hypostasis of the ousia. I'm an instance of the essence. Does that make sense? I'm an instance of the essence, as philosophers say. So, all that means is that I bear the property. I'm one with humanity. I am an individual instance of the human essence. And so are all others. So that's what's happening here, is that when he says Son of God, he is meaning I am one instance of the essence God. I bear the property Godness. I am the instantiation, instance of the essence God, deity. That's what Jesus is saying when he says Son of God. That's what people mean when they say Son of God. You are the same thing as, in essence, substance, and spirit, and all likeness, you are the same thing as God. You come from God, therefore you're God himself. And so that's what's happening here. When you claim to be the Son of God, you're saying, I am of the same essence as God. Okay? The way he related to others showed that he thought he was exclusive and different. So this is evident line of evidence, and there's plenty of passages in the scripture where we can bring up that says that Jesus thought he was extremely different. The phrases that he used to refer to himself showed uniqueness and authority. So again, himself differently. I am. He calls himself the Son of Man. He lets other people call himself the Son of God. He implies that he's the Son of God. And he says interesting things. He says things like, Amen, I say to you, which means basically, on my own authority, these words are true. He says things like, It was said, but I say to you, and a new commandment I give to you. So he's putting his word on equal status as God's words. He's saying that this is the law that you know, but I say to you this. You have heard this, but now I say to you this. So he's basically taking the Mosaic law and adding to it, which was obviously a big deal. He says, all authority is given to me in heaven and on earth. He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one cometh to the Father but by me. So you have to come to God only through him. So we've heard these things, but I'm giving you them, I'm spelling them out right here for you, because there's direct evidence that disputes and refutes the claims of a guy like Don Cupid and the people on the internet forums that say he didn't even think he was God's son. He tells people to pray in his name. He calls God Abba. He says, son of man, we talked about. Now, here's where it gets interesting. He actually claims to be equal with God. So, in other words, claiming God's son is one thing, because it's kind of implied that you're God. But here he claims directly, I am God. Jews knew monotheism only. So when you said, hey, I am God, you're I am Yahweh. I am that guy, Jehovah Yahweh, that's up there that we all sacrifice to. I'm him. He says, I am, and this is known as the Yahweh, YHWH, the Tetragrammaton. Tetragrammaton. Has anybody heard of that? Okay, Tetragrammaton is just the big $60 million word for Yahweh, YHWH. There's four letters, there's no vowels, because the Hebrew has no vowels. YHWH is where we get Jehovah, the Greek word for Yahweh. The J is from the Y, the H is from the H, the W is the E, and the is the last H. So Tetragrammaton is a way to talk about Yahweh without saying Yahweh, and scholars use that all the time, historians. So when you hear or read in a book Tetragrammaton, you know what it means. You know what it means now. He says, I and the Father are one, directly and clearly indicates that he is God. One with God, the same as God, essentially. Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. Okay? Now, let me get a little deeper on you. Item E. He says, and I want you to do this with your pen, when you see an equal sign in the next five statements, I want you to circle it. I am the good shepherd, he says in John 10:11, equals, quote, Yahweh is my shepherd. When the Old Testament says, the Lord, and the Lord is all caps, they mean Yahweh, they just don't write it wrong and have lots of problems with God because they wrote his name wrong. So he says, when David says in Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Jesus says, I am the good shepherd, I'm that guy. He says, he will come at the end of time to judge the world, sitting on a throne in heavenly glory in Matthew and in John. He says that twice. Or we have that twice, equals, I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations, and this is God speaking to the prophet Joel in 12. So he says, you know, when we talk about Yahweh judging all the nations, I'm that guy, because he talked about in Matthew and John, I didn't write it all out, that he was going to come and judge the world while he's sitting on the throne. So he's claiming to be God by saying that. And then this next passage here, we don't have to read it, but he's basically saying that I give life and those who hear my voice will live. And this is equals the Old Testament passage that is listed here, where God said he was the giver of life and he was the one to raise the dead. So Jesus is saying, I give life, I raise the dead. But Jews knew that God was the one to do that. And we see that in those passages. Jesus spoke as the bridegroom. And that is equivalent to the passages there in the Old Testament where Yahweh identifies himself this way. Yahweh spoke of himself as the bridegroom. Jesus says, I'm the bridegroom. I'm that God. I'm that God. He says, I am the light of the world. This is equivalent to the Old Testament passage where it says, the Lord is my light, or Yahweh is my light. Jesus says, I am that light. So clearly, Jesus is saying things that we all recognize and hold, and we just pass. But if we slow down, we can really say that these are this is the evidence that we have, and this disputes and refutes the claims by the scholars and the skeptics. So based on his statements and how he refers to himself, it is clear that Jesus believes he is the Son of God and in some sense equivalent in nature with God. Now, Dr. Peter Kreft discusses how he was a believable person, although his teachings were hard to accept. His claim about his divinity was almost unbelievable. So Peter Kreft says, they had to either believe his almost unbelievable claim or disbelieve his very believable person. So there's a dilemma that Jesus presents to them and all of us. We have to believe something almost unbelievable, that a man is God, or disbelieve this very believable, compelling figure in Jesus. What do we do? And that's what they were faced with. That's what we're faced with. This is our dilemma today. Jesus clearly claims to be God. What do we do with this information? Believe what seems unbelievable or reject it, even though Jesus is so compelling of a teacher? And so, who was this guy? Who was this guy? This is where the Lord Liar Trilemma. We prove that Jesus actually said he was God. He seemed to believe he was God. So if he believed it, but he wasn't, then he was a lunatic. But if he didn't believe he was a God, and he said it anyway, then he was lying. So here's the power to this. Talk about who was Jesus, who was he? We can agree as Christians with everyone else on these four things. He was a sage. We agree. He was a moral philosopher. We agree with that too. He wasn't secular, but he was a moral philosopher. He was a trusted teacher. He was a prophet. We agree with that. So you can talk to a Muslim, Hindu, atheist, and they will all say this. The person on the street, oh, I think Jesus, he was kind. He liked kids. You know, you can't fault him. He didn't do nobody wrong. You know, he was kind of weird, you know, hung out with a bunch of weirdos in the desert area. But other than that, how can you get mad at Jesus? So we can all agree with these four things. Now, the problem is, as C.S. Lewis demonstrates, Jesus was not just that. And to say that he was just that is incorrect. This is what he says in Lewis's famous work, Mere Christianity. I am trying to prevent anyone from saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. Quote, I am ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is, the one thing we must not say, a man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else is a madman or something worse. There's a big seven right there. It's just supposed to be a superscript there, referring to the footnote. But the point he's making is that he wasn't a moral teacher in that alone. Because if he was a moral teacher and then said, trust me with your eternal destiny, then he would be a demon. That's what Lewis is saying. Or he'd be a lunatic. And so, obviously, Jesus also could have been lying. And that's what we're getting into here as well. C.S. Lewis says that someone can't say he was a great moral teacher only. C.S. Lewis gives us three options. Lord, liar, lunatic. Option one, liar. We already just went through that. Those options there. So the third option is he was liar, Lord. And so if we can, as Christians, claim that he was a liar, and if we can refute the claim that he was a lunatic, then the only other option, according to Lewis, is that he was Lord. He was who he says he was. Now, recently, since C.S. Lewis put this together 50, 60 years ago, other ways to get out of the dilemma have out of the woodworks. However, the other options are faulty. They have some issues. So, option four would be Jesus was a God, which means Jesus claimed to be God, but what he meant is a God. Jesus claimed to be a God, just as we are all gods. So this option is unsatisfactory. Sip some coffee. Let me ask this. Do you have any questions at this point? Okay. You do? Okay, go ahead.
To give the three options that C.S. Lewis talks about, are they willing to debate that question, but they are accepting the God of the Old Testament is a God, was real, or are they denying that as well?
Are you talking about a sick person? Probably not. These guys are just so skeptical. They just don't. Yeah, yeah. And Don Cupid, he's not a Christian, so. Yeah. Okay, so if Jesus said, or if he meant when he said, I am God, essentially, that he, what he really meant was a God, then we have another option, don't we? The problem, though, is that there's this first. The first problem is its reliance on pantheistic or even new or Hindu data that is not simply found in the Gospels. So nothing Jesus said or his followers understood even closely resembles the a God of many gods scenario, as they lived in a monotheistic culture, and Jesus clearly claimed the monotheistic Jewish God role when he claimed, I am. So we don't find elements or understanding of a multi-God in the ancient Jewish mind. The second problem is, if Jesus was a God, he was a very bad, terribly bad teacher, because no one, friends or enemies, actually understood what he meant. Only the clever people 2,000 years later actually understood that he meant a God of many gods. But this is obviously culturally arrogant of these very clever people. They are claiming they knew what Jesus meant, and the Jews of Jesus' time did not. This is ridiculous, as Jesus was also a Jew, lived among the Jews, and the main teaching of Judaism is the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is the Lord is one. Contradicting the Shema is blasphemous and results in capital punishment. Jesus' life was threatened, and there were plots to kill Jesus when he made the claims, because they knew exactly who he was claiming to be. So option four fails. You can't get option four when you actually look at the Bible and understand the Jews at the time really only understood monotheism, and they were ready to kill Jesus when he claimed to be that God. And if Jesus was teaching that he was one God of many gods, he did a very horrible job of that, because no disciple understood what he meant. So this claim is just culturally arrogant for people to say, but people say it. Especially the New Age sorts of folks. Now, the fifth option is a little better, but not still doesn't work. The fifth option is just to deny the data, claiming that the historical Jesus never actually said that he was God. But this option is clearly unsatisfactory, as we just saw with all those Bible passages, that he did claim that he was God. Like I said earlier in those passages, it's pretty clear. The data in the Gospels is clear, concise, and compelling. Besides the far-left fringe wing of the Jesus Seminar, who discredits the historical Jesus, no scholars deny the data of Jesus' claims. Okay? Besides those guys. This ultimately entails that the disciples all fabricated the data that Jesus said he was God, meaning the disciples lied. That is, the real Jesus never claimed to be God, but the disciples lied and said he did. But why would the disciples lie? For a selfish motive? like fame or financial gain? We know that all the disciples were tortured and killed for their belief, one who was exiled, and they did not retract anything they claimed. So if they were lying, they never confessed they were lying, even in the midst of torture and death. So option 5 fails. And thus we are back with the liar, lunatic, and Lord dilemma. Do you guys see that? So if Jesus wasn't lying, but the disciples just made up this stuff about Jesus when he was just a good moral teacher, but then they start saying that Jesus said he was God, then they would be lying if he wasn't. But we don't have any reason to doubt the disciples or the authors of the New Testament. In fact, it's clear that they weren't lying, and they believed everything they wrote and claimed because they went to their deaths for it. And no one would die believing a lie when they know it's a lie. They believe things that they know to be true. They go to their deaths dying for things because their belief is sincere and they're willing to die for it. So the disciples, we can say, weren't lying either. Jesus actually did say what he said. They didn't fabricate that and write that in. Yes, sir. Right. Well, it reinforces the point, though, that they died believing David Koresh was Jesus, or Jim Jones was Jesus, whatever he said he was.
They'll use that as these people died for Jesus, thinking he was Jesus, but he's just nothing.
Right. But they still believed with all their heart, very sincerely, that he was that person.
Which proves they were not lying.
Which means that they're not dying for what they know to be untrue. They died because they believed it. They knew it to be true. We all knew it wasn't. Yeah, we know that, but they believed it was. We know that it was false, but they thought it was true. And they're willing to die for it. So the same thing with the martyrs today, the Islamic, you know, guys that blow themselves up. They believe very, very firmly that when they blow themselves up, they're going to have a bunch of virgins on the other side and live in paradise. And then they do it because they believe with all their heart that that is true. That is going to happen. They wouldn't do it if they had doubts, even to the slightest extent. I doubt they'd do it.
It's like that falls under what we'll cover later about all the different
religions, which is true. Yeah. Yeah. Now, and then you have to say, okay, well, if all these people die for what they believe to be true, then which one's true? Well, then this is where we go back into all these other branches of apologetics. So dying for something doesn't mean that that thing is true. It just means that you believe with all your heart that it is. And you could be wrong. Be sure. And same thing with us. We better be sure that we're not wasting our life, wasting our time, believing a lie. If Jesus didn't rise from the grave, if he wasn't God, and we think he was, and we think he rose, and he didn't, then we, that's what Paul says, we are to be pitied. Our faith is futile. It's in vain. It's worthless. It's a waste of time. And so this is important. If Jesus didn't believe that he was God, but he died on the cross and the stories of his resurrection were fabricated, we're screwed. We're the dumbest people on the planet, Christians, you know. So we better be dang sure that Jesus really said that he was God. And like we pointed out, when he made his equivalent statements to the God of the Old Testament himself, those equal signs, he really did say that. So we can have certainty that Jesus said that. The disciples didn't throw it in. Yeah, you have another question? Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Do the same scholars say that Jesus made these claims?
No. Well, okay. The 99% that I talked about last week, those people say that Jesus existed. Now, there's less people that say Jesus actually said this stuff. So like the Jesus seminar would say Jesus never said that he was God or the Son of Man or all this stuff. So there's less. Maybe 90% then of scholars think that Jesus actually said what he said. 99% say Jesus existed. Oh, yeah. So again, the Jesus seminar, I'm being liberal when I say that 10%. The Jesus seminar is a fringe group of liberal scholars. They don't represent all of a liberal scholarship. No, not at all. Liberal scholars are people that you find teaching like at Claremont School of Theology, Union Seminary up in Berkeley, Princeton sometimes. But though the fringe or the super liberal guys from there, those are the guys that go to the Jesus seminar things. Now, I'm glad you brought that up. I did some extra research this week, and I found two other scholars besides the one I mentioned last week. I mentioned Robert Price. There's two others that think Jesus did not exist, and I didn't know about them until this weekend. One I'm familiar with. His name is Richard Carrier. He teaches at Columbia University in New York. He just got his PhD a few years ago, but he's a force to be reckoned with and very admirable opponent. I wrestled with an article of his when I was in seminary and wrote a response to it. Richard Carrier, with two R's in the middle. And he has written actually, I don't know, 6 to 12 books or so already. And he's only like 38 or maybe 40, something like that. He's not super seasoned, but he's very articulate, and he paints a very broad or bad picture of the Bible, stuff that we're actually talking about tonight. So he is one who I would be more afraid of than Don Cupid, who's this old guy kind of on his last leg. But this guy we're going to have to deal with for a long time, Richard Carrier. He's going to be way bigger than the Richard Dawkins guy and Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris, the new atheists, you know. So look up Richard Carrier, and he's got a few books. I wrote them down. Another one of them that doesn't believe that Jesus existed is Earl Doherty, Doherty. And he's kind of one of these more older dudes, kind of like Don Cupid and Robert Price. And so he's been around a while. And he's kind of a disciple of a historian, G.A. Wells, who in the 70s actually made the claim Jesus didn't exist. G.A. Wells and him kind of thought alike for many years, but now G.A. Wells is a person who holds to a more mystical view of Jesus, that he was or mythical or kind of semi-real, semi-fabricated. So he doesn't, G.A. Wells does not hold to the view that Jesus did not exist like his follower, disciple, Earl Doherty does. So over the time, G.A. Wells has changed his view to become more moderate. But it's still very liberal to say that Jesus was semi-mythical, semi-real. But I'm just giving you this information because I want you to know that there's a couple other guys out there. Now, is it now 98%? No. You still have thousands of scholars who held that Jesus existed, and you still only have like three guys that say he didn't. You know, you just have to, what do you do with that? Do you reference those guys if you're an atheist online proving your point? I wouldn't. I wouldn't go there. Okay. So I think this is a good point to take a break. Are there any questions that are hot on your mind, pressing? Okay, so why don't we take a 7-minute break or so, be back maybe a few minutes after 8. Okay? We just started, okay? All right. Item 4. Psychological evidence, the identity of Jesus. Was he a lunatic? Was Jesus crazy claiming to be the Son of God? So this is a popular thing you may hear. I don't know. Jesus, like every other crazy who claims to be God, is delusional and needs psychiatric drugs. Maybe you've heard that, maybe not. But some people say it. Was Jesus suffering from a mental illness? From a current diagnosis of a clinical psychologist, there are no signs of mental illness. So we have someone that evaluated or diagnosed Jesus and was asking these questions. Could he be thought of as a person with a mental illness? And this is what the professional psychologist said. He demonstrated appropriate emotions, healthy anger and sadness. He was in contact with reality and showed no signs of paranoia, no difficulty with logic, no irrationality, no misperceptions. He related socially to others and did not dress weird. He had a deep and continuous relationships with a variety of people. He loved and responded to people where they were at, but he didn't let compassion immobilize him. He did not ramble, but his speeches were brilliant, eloquent, motivating, and powerful, not to mention filled with tremendous insight into the human condition. He didn't have a bloated ego, but handled the fame and the crowds very well, all while maintaining personal balance despite the demands of the ministry. So sometimes we see him going off to the hills to have alone time. He didn't let the fame of his ministry build his ego. So Gary Collins says, "All in all, I just don't see signs that Jesus was suffering from any known mental illness. He was much healthier than anyone else I know, including me." So this is obviously a big statement from a professional psychologist who has written tons of books and is a leader in the field. Now, what about the Jews that said he was manitai, raving mad? Okay, that's the Greek word manitai, in John 10:20, or his family who said he was existe. I'm not sure what that little square is. I think it's supposed to be an epsilon, which is an E, basically. Existe, out of his mind, in Mark 3:21. So people point to these scriptures and say, well, here's a scripture where Jews thought Jesus was raving mad. So other people around him thought he was crazy. So this is evidence for us that Jesus was crazy too. If they thought it and they were right next to him, why shouldn't we think it? And his own family said he's out of his mind. He's existe. So what do we do with this data? Well, let's look at each one. Raving mad in this context is not a comprehensive or professional psychological analysis, but is the reaction of some in the crowd who were shocked at his teaching about the Good Shepherd and wanted to say something negative, like, "Oh, you're crazy." They said this because Jesus' teaching and his assertions were almost unbelievable. To the Jews listening, Jesus spoke blasphemous expressions about being God and gave alternate ideas of God's kingdom beyond their understanding. So this is kind of the reaction from the crowd. And you would may do the same thing if you heard something kind of outlandish for our culture. You may be like, "This guy's nuts. You know, why should we believe him?" and walk away mad. Like, "I can't believe you're saying that about Mother Teresa. What's wrong with you, lunatic?" You know, you may get upset at some things like that too. So this may be like an off-the-cuff remark. But is it a clinical diagnosis of Jesus' state of mind? Are they saying that Jesus has a mental illness, that he needs psychiatric drugs? No, it's not even in that context. So he was portraying a very different Messiah than they expected, and some were just not ready for his teaching. Okay, now, the next verse, let me see if I want to keep going on that topic. Let's skip down to take charge. Okay, 7, out of his mind, on page 25. So this is the other passage. Out of his mind is better translated lost his senses or beside himself. This implies a temporary but major state of stress, there should be a "of" there, rather than a permanent psychological mental illness. So in other words, when his family were saying he's out of his mind, we have to get him and get him out of this crowd of people that he's teaching, it's better translated lost senses or beside himself, which is kind of a temporary state of mind. It doesn't mean a mental illness. They came to take charge of him, it says, or seize him, as they were most likely embarrassed and afraid of the Pharisees who had just learned of Jesus' healing large numbers of people. So this is at the very beginning of Jesus' public ministry, and he starts healing people left and right and doing some crazy stuff, and or big time stuff. And the Pharisees hear about it, and they are starting to, you know, realize who this guy is. So his family, growing up in that culture, realizes Jesus is pissing off the authorities, and they want to, you know, get Jesus away from the crowds and get him out of the public spotlight because their family is starting to look kind of ridiculous. So they don't want to upset the Pharisees. It's like upsetting the pastor today. We don't want to upset pastors, you know. So Albert Barnes adds, now Albert Barnes wrote this Bible commentary back in 1884, I reference him down there. He says, the reason why this report, parentheses, that Jesus has lost his senses, gained any belief, probably, was probably that he had lived among them as a carpenter. He was poor and unknown, and that now, at 30 years of age, he broke off from his occupations, abandoned his common employment, spent much time in the deserts, denied himself the common comforts of life, and set up his claims to be the Messiah, who is expected by all to come with great pomp and splendor. So, as a carpenter, and you go start living in Barstow, or beyond that, Mojave Desert, and then you come back and start doing some, you know, fascinating things, you know, people may say that you've kind of lost touch with reality a little bit. The problem was, Jesus was healing people. He wasn't just teaching crazy stuff. In fact, Jesus' teachings, like we talked about, were powerful. They were moving. They were intelligent and articulate. Then he healed people. So it wasn't like he came back saying all this weird stuff and started teaching, so to speak, with weird stuff and then start beating people with a baseball bat. You know, kind of crazy behavior. And then you could say, okay, you went off to the desert, you got weird, and you came back and you're nuts. Fine. Not the case here. So this is his theory that, you know, people were kind of, hey, you're doing this for one moment, and then and you start this public ministry. So they got a little freaked out, like, Jesus, what's happening to you? What's going on with you? Calm down. Stop healing people. So his closest family or friends were a little freaked out at this behavior and new attention, and the best they could come up with at the time was to try to control Jesus, who was just breaking out into a massive public ministry. Now, it's interesting how we try to control Jesus, too, all the time. We like to emphasize certain things he said, but not emphasize others. We do it all the time. So we can't be too mad at them. Thus, based on the data above, others who seem to claim that Jesus was mad may not have even believed that he was psychologically disordered, but rather temporarily beside himself, or were just angry at what he taught. If they did think he was mad, they truly misjudged him, which is also clear from the demon-possessed remark, because they said, the first verse we read is that he's raving mad and demon-possessed. They said that all at the same time. So they clearly were trying to bash him, his character, too, at the same time. And they did not even point to any signs of mental illness. Like, you're doing this, you're doing that, this is crazy behavior. They weren't indicating that. So these are just kind of off-the-cuff remarks. And again, when we understand what they're saying, we know that they're not saying that he was mentally ill. Now, here's a good question. What if Jesus was a hypnotist? Ever heard of this one? What if Jesus was a hypnotist? The problem here is that hypnosis, if efficacious, is only really for one person. Hypnosis is not for groups of people. For example, he fed 5,000 people at once, healed in front of others, and raised Lazarus from the dead with other people around. So the problem here is that hypnosis can't explain these as well as many other miracles. So this view is rejected. So to hypnotize Milton, but it's another thing to hypnotize all of you. Hypnosis only works for one person. No hypnotist is going to try to hypnotize a lot of people at once. If you go to the state fair, you may see a hypnotist bring up people on stage. I was in one of these things one time, and he brings up a buddy of mine, actually. He goes up on the stage with like 12 other people out of the crowd. And the way they do it is they look at you, and they look at your face, and they realize who's a little bit excited, who's a little bit vulnerable, and they'll tell you to come up. So he goes up there, and he starts barking like a dog and doing some weird stuff after the hypnotist goes through a few things. But again, the hypnotist was talking to him directly at the time and was talking to the other people directly. Called them their name, say, blah, blah, blah. When you hear this bell, you're going to become a dog. And so I don't know if it works. I've never been hypnotized, but people sure do act it out quite well and convincingly. If hypnotism is real, you know, who cares? It doesn't matter to the Christian faith. Magic and demonic things, I think, are more prevalent than we think. So I think maybe a little bit of hypnotism has to do with a little bit of demonic activity, same as magic, but that's another topic. So I don't know why I put this into the Jesus lunatic section, but I figured it was kind of funny and interesting. So people say that Jesus hypnotized all these people with the miracles, just like some other miracle workers did in the ancient Near East, and they make the similar claim, and they say Jesus isn't unique because there's a bunch of people like him doing other things, but they were hypnotists. And you can easily fool people into thinking that you're doing miracles now. There's some stuff on YouTube about it. I was just emailed by some skeptic guy in Europe sending me some YouTube videos to watch of how you can easily trick people into believing that you do miracles, and therefore Jesus did the same thing. So people actually do kind of attack Jesus like this. So overall, Jesus' sound teachings on morality, truth, and Old Testament law are so profound and powerful, they are incredibly regarded as the best philosophical understanding of ethics any wise man or scholar ever delivered. So if you read philosophers who specialize in ethics, nobody has written things like Jesus has in regards to the human condition, how to deal with anger, forgiveness, things like this. No one has said the things like Jesus has said and taught an ethic like Jesus has. Nobody. And philosophers always point back to this. They always will, because he was, in their point of view, one of the greatest moral philosophers ever. And since that time, philosophers have tried to generate an ethical theory that matches Jesus's. And in my opinion, they have failed. There are some good ethical theories out there, but most of them are bad, like utilitarianism and things like this. We'll get into ethics later on, but it's quite interesting how Jesus gave us, what insight Jesus gave us, how we think and who we are and why we do the things we do, and what is right. Jesus is considered by much of the world as one of the greatest teachers to ever live, and this is secular and Christian. So Jesus was probably the most opposite of crazy you could get, and is much smarter and healthier than we are. Therefore, he was not a lunatic. So if you teach the things like Jesus taught, and you have that much insight that you're regarded as one of the world's greatest ethicists, you're crazy. Okay, so that's pretty clear. So we've refuted the idea that he was a liar. We refuted the idea that he was a lunatic. So what are we left with? Lord. We are left with Lord. What evidence does Jesus provide supports his claim of deity? This is kind of considered the profile evidence. So do we have any positive evidence of Jesus actually being God? He says he was God. He didn't reject this idea that when other people said he was God, he didn't refute that. But what did he do? Is there anything he did that helps us move forward on this view, or do we just accept it because it's the last resort and it's the other option we have with this trilemma? Well, it turns out that we have 10 different evidences that show the divinity of Jesus. And so we can say with great confidence, not just like, dang, I guess he was the Lord because the other ones don't work. No, we have great confidence that he was the Lord. Look at these lines of evidence. He performed many miracles, and he used miracles to prove his deity to people. He healed people. He raised the dead people to life. He cast out demons. He modified water and multiplied food. So he manipulated matter. He walked on the water. He controlled the weather. Number two, he was without sin. Only God was thought to be sinless. Here's a bunch of things that help us see that Jesus was without sin. Now, item five, look at that real quick. Do you think it's possible for Jesus to, do you think it was possible for Jesus to sin? Could Jesus have sinned if he wanted to? Could Jesus have sinned if he wanted to? What are your thoughts? Give me some feedback. If he actually did, right? Yeah. But could he have? You say no. Why? Because he's God, but he was also man, right? Say it again. So you're saying that if he could have sinned, that means his abilities were limited?
No,
if he couldn't have sinned. Okay, so you both are saying, yes, he could have.
No, he's saying he couldn't have.
No, you're saying yes, and he's saying no. Yes, sir. Okay. Interesting. Yeah, that's true. Yes. So you're not sure, but you think God, he's God, and God can't change, and he can't sin, so he can't. Mm-hmm. But could Jesus have sinned? Yes, sir.
I think it says like Jesus was tempted. I think the fact that he was tempted suggests that he could have sinned. I mean, there was a temptation for him to sin, so I think it suggests that he could have.
That's a great insight. I want you to hear what he said. Temptation implies, implies that the opportunity was there, doesn't it? But could he have been tempted but still not have the capacity to sin? Because in his heart, it be inclined that way. Because he's God, is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Well, because he is God, and because God has to have only positive morals.
Okay. Yeah, like God is holy and just and things like that.
Yeah, but okay. If he was fully man, fully God, fully man, he'd be able to sin, be able to kill.
Yeah, so there's another point for the capability here you're making. If you're fully man, then you have to have that capability. Yeah. It's good insight. Yes. So this is... Yeah, he wouldn't have been because he would have sinned. He wouldn't have been the unblemished lamb. But it's... So, you know, we know he didn't sin. What I'm trying to help us think about is whether he could have, whether he was capable of it. Most of the time we think of Jesus as being... he couldn't have because he was God. But what does it mean to be fully man? Does it also mean that you have the capability to sin? Or it does mean that. So we have to think about these things. How does that work when you get a person like Jesus? Now, this is known as the impeccability of Christ. This is what theologians term in systematic theology as the impeccability of Christ, whether or not he sinned. Now, that's not really relevant completely to our or not. He could have sinned, but I want you to think about it this week, and maybe if you're so inclined, open up a systematic theology book and look into it. It doesn't matter whatever side you land on, whether he could have sinned or could not have sinned, but it just I want you to get your brains thinking about it. Item three, or this is the third evidence that is positive towards the view that Jesus was actually Lord. He forgave this. The moment Jesus' life points to his divinity is his forgiving of sin. Only God and the other persons could be wronged in sin. So the scribes correctly respond, who can forgive sins but God alone? So when Jesus walks around forgiving people of their sins, it means that Jesus was the person offended by the sin, as well as the other people. So when people are sinning in general, they're offending God. God has to forgive them. And Jesus did that. And this is, by some theologians, the most striking feature that reveals his deity, the biggest positive piece of evidence that we have. Or he accepted worship, which the Old Testament forbids anyone from doing other than God. So angels and disciples rejected worship in the New Testament because they knew the significance of it. So here we have a list of people who worship Jesus, and this is something that angels and disciples rejected because they knew that when you receive worship, you're basically saying that I'm God. Item five, he title of my Lord and my God by Thomas. So he was called God directly, accepted it. He changed people's names, something only God does, as the Hebrew names refer to their identity and the divine destiny that God designed. So when God gives you a name in the Hebrew, ancient Near East, that means this is part of your identity of how God made you and designed you, but it's also part of your destiny. So your name is not only your identity, but it's part of your destiny, and it's very revealing about who you are. In the Old Testament, we see that a lot. Jesus changed people's names. He changed Peter's name, and that's a sign of, obviously, of being God. He spoke with power and authority that others recognized. Interesting, the mob of soldiers fell down when he spoke, I am he. They drew back and fell to the ground. So when he spoke, he had so much of a presence. He was so powerful a figure that it caused people to fall backwards, even soldiers. guards who encountered said, no one ever spoke the way this man does. People recognize there's something powerful about this person. The people were astonished, for he taught them as one with authority. Item 8, his divinity was confirmed by voices from heaven at his baptism and transfiguration. Okay, perfect. That's the time to wrap up. And item 9, he prophesied his own death and resurrection and fulfilled it. And item 10, he ascended to heaven. So here's 10 lines of evidence for Jesus being God. And another one that I didn't include here is that his followers were fully convinced he was God incarnate, and the scriptural data for this is obvious in the apostles' writing. There's no need for me to list it here. 10 lines of evidence above adds up to a full case showing that Jesus is God. Responses to critics who claim Jesus didn't fulfill the attributes of God, I have here. So critics say that Jesus was not God. He wasn't omnipresent. He wasn't omnipotent. He wasn't omniscient. And they say this because he says things like he didn't even have a day or hour of his do miracles in his hometown. Couldn't be two places at once. So how do we respond to that when people say, well, Jesus obviously wasn't God because he couldn't do these things. He didn't even know the day or the hour of his second coming. Well, this is a very, very huge topic. I do list some scriptures where it does show that he did fulfill the attributes of God right here. But this is a huge topic because basically you have to get into Christology and the theology of what sort of a being was Jesus Christ. Was God and man, 100% God and 100% man. And you have to start to learn how to differentiate between these things without and speak about it without speaking heresy. And it took 300 years for the fathers to come up with a formulation that wasn't heretical, that made sense of the data in the Gospels that he was 100% man and 100% God. Paul says he emptied himself of his divine attributes. And I talk about that here in a little bit. So I think I'd like to stop here at this point because what I'm presenting here is a topic, and we're not really going to get into it next time. We're going to continue there with the item at the bottom. But I'm just giving it to you because you're going to hear this critique about Jesus being not God because he could not do these things. And I want you to just look into it a little bit. Now, keep in mind, when Paul says he emptied himself of him of his divine attributes, it's a very vague term. We don't know what Paul really means when he says emptied himself. We can guess as scholars and theologians, but when Paul says that, it means something to the effect of Jesus didn't bring all of his divine attributes from heaven down with him. He left some there. And so therefore, he wasn't engaged on earth like he would as if he was in heaven. And so that was kind of a choice, and I'll talk about a little bit here. But I wanted to just present a couple of these things and saying that we do have some good evidence that Jesus fulfilled his attributes, even though in other places it looks like he didn't. So you have to look at the whole chunk of scripture and say, well, over here he couldn't do things, but over here he obviously did do these things, which shows his omnipotence. All right. Are there any questions? Okay, it's 8:45 exactly, which is when we like to finish up. Would someone like to pray and close? If you want, someone was asking if they could pray for me tomorrow to go speak to Canada. I'd love that. We could do something after, and whoever wants to stay and pray, I'd really appreciate it. This is the first time I've spoke internationally in a few years, so I'm excited to do it again. And Canada is definitely hard soil, if you will, rocky soil, kind of like Australia in Europe. So I have a feeling there's going to be some hard-nosed atheists there that are coming who are going to be challenging me on some stuff. All right, would anybody like to close us in prayer? Milton, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. That was very nice of you.